Again, it's very, very good to be here. Can you hear me okay in the back? System's on, I believe. Okay. So again, very good to be here. And when I was considering what to explore this time and next time, I remembered that the theme that I explored last time I was here was using heart practices, especially we looked at forgiveness and compassion at difficult times, and how to work in particularly with those practices. And I thought to continue the theme of how we can practice, so to speak, how we can use our best mindfulness, insight, compassion, and wisdom with challenging circumstances. And I wanted to particularly, this time and next time, look at that in the context of working with challenging thoughts and emotions, and give a focus on how we practice in general with thoughts and emotions, and then how we practice with challenging thoughts and emotions. And I think we could say that working with challenging thoughts and emotions is right at the heart of our practice. And it's also not hard to see, with all the pain in the world at the current time, that one way to approach those difficulties and crises is to see that people and whole countries get locked in repetitive, reactive patterns. And that skillful work with thoughts and emotions is incredibly valuable personally, but it's also, I believe, a key to, it's a key to peace. And it's a key to working with the challenges of the world as well, which can be understood in part as reactivity of thoughts and emotions and bodies going out of control, or getting locked into cyclical repetitive patterns, which can lead to violence and sustained violence. So I'll return to that theme of how this is connected with the world from time to time. The main focus will be on our own practice. Does the sound okay? I think this, the green light is on here. Does that mean it's okay?
Okay.
I think it might be better now. Now there's a red light on.
There's no light on.
Okay.
No, there's green. Green.
Green.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's it.
Very good. Thank you. So if anyone had any challenging thoughts and emotions just in that interlude, how do you work skillfully with them? So what I want to do is really go over maybe, I think, three areas. The first is to look more generally at the heart of our practice being about being responsive rather than reactive. And then secondly, I want to look at more briefly at the different tools that we might have for working with thoughts and emotions, including difficult ones. And then thirdly, I want to particularly focus on mindfulness of thoughts and emotions. And then fourth, if I have time, I want to go into some particular difficult emotions. I was thinking of this time and next time looking at fear, anger, maybe judgmental mind, and sadness and grief. That's a lot, so I may just get to a few of those, but I want to bring those in as examples, because those are some of the primal challenging emotions and thoughts, and they usually come as complex, as thoughts and emotions come as patterns, actually very much embodied as well. One of the ways to understand the heart of our practice is to see that we examine and transform reactivity and we move towards responsiveness. I think this is a way, actually, to talk about the Four Noble Truths. That if we wanted to talk about this center of the Buddhist tradition in a contemporary, secular, fairly simple way, I think that we could talk about becoming responsive rather than being reactive. Often, we actually use the term reactivity as a metaphor for dukkha or suffering. Not a metaphor, but really a way of understanding in a very simple way suffering or dukkha. And that we often think of that reactivity as having these two main forms. One of them is being reactive and grabbing hold of things. And the other form is when we push away things. You know, and so for the first, we have grasping, greed, wanting, and so forth. For the latter, we have aversion, anger, irritation, fear, whole complexes of emotions. And we, I think, can best understand dukkha, or suffering, as reactivity, as being caught in these cycles where we're compulsively driven to react to something rather than to be present with it and to be able to respond out of wisdom and compassion. In that sense, being responsive is the intention of our practice every moment. How can I be responsive? In a sense, we have to really be responsive. There has to be freedom in that moment, or else we're being driven. So again, I find responsiveness is something that is a term that you can take with you. You can go into a meeting and say, let me be as responsive as I can, or let me look at reactivity. So I think it's a very good handle on our practice, and it really is the heart of it. It's being able to be responsive, which means to act not out of reactivity, but out of our best wisdom and compassion moment to moment. Now, it's especially challenging when there are challenging thoughts and emotions and challenging situations. That's when reactivity comes up more readily, as we know, right? That we can see that reactivity occurring. We can look at that and we can see how we get taken out of our ability to respond out of our kind heart. And we could see our practice as learning how to be responsive. I mean, I think that's really all it is. The all is a lot. Right? And in many ways, I did, you know, like many of you, I've been reading about some of the crisis areas in the world. And we could actually see what's going on now as just tremendous reactivity in most of the crises. But I was particularly looking at the crisis in Israel and Gaza, and just the way that violence begets violence. You know, and I found two quotations. One was from today's New York Times. So maybe some of you saw this. It was from an article, Hospitals in Gaza Overwhelmed as Attacks Continue. And this is from a young, there was an interview with a young Palestinian man. Mohammed Albana said an airstrike the morning before had killed 9 of his in-laws, including his wife's father and 4 of her brothers. And he said, the aggression here is creating a new generation of youth who want revenge for all the crimes, he said. You know, that there is a way, you know, we know that much of the core of the teaching is, I have received pain, I inflict pain on others. That's a primal form of reactivity. And again, in a way, one of the translations from lines in the Dhammapada from the Buddha says, violence never ends violence. Only love ends violence. Some of you know that text. And we can see, again, these cycles of violence. Or in another, there was a an article that I read by Michael Nagler. Some of you may know Michael Nagler. He was the founder of Peace and Conflict Studies at Berkeley, University of California, Berkeley. Does anyone study with him? Yeah, some of you did. And Michael went to, actually was the latter part of June in Israel and Palestine. And he, you know, his focus especially is nonviolent action. And he was meeting with some of the Israeli as well as Palestinian activists. And he had one meeting with a Palestinian nonviolent advocate. And he said to him, you know, it feels, this was before any of the violence, he says, it feels to me like in many ways different actions just provoke you to violence, you personally. And his response was, I will never be provoked to violence. And I think that's actually the commitment we make with our practice, in a way. We could say I make a commitment with my practice to stay responsive in every situation as best I can, and to really, as best I can, not be reactive. So in many of the parts of our lives, things go smoothly, right? And then we have challenging situations where we may find ourselves reactive. You may have had some reactivity even in the last half hour, or today, or yesterday, right? And we want to look at that reactivity and, in a way, take on this challenge of first really learning the different tools we learn to work with thoughts and emotions, difficult situations, mindfulness, heart practices, wisdom teachings, and so forth. But we, at a certain point, we have learned enough mindfulness, we've learned enough of the perspective, we have some of the heart practices, and we can start deliberately looking for challenging situations as places where our practice can expand, where we can expand our practice and move it more into where there are challenges. The Buddha was talking often. You can find a lot of passages where he said, take on challenges, you know. Don't just keep it comfy. Technical term. Right? He said, some practitioner is extremely kind, extremely gentle, extremely peaceful, so long as disagreeable courses of speech do not touch him or her. But it is when disagreeable courses of speech touch him or her that it can be understood whether that practitioner is really kind, gentle, and peaceful. Right? So at a certain point, we get interested in where we lose it. We get interested in where we get stuck, and we start to bring the practice there and really work with this intention to take responsiveness as the center of my life and where I want to act from moment to moment. And so we're naturally very interested to see where we are reactive, where we can't be so responsive, where there's a pattern that just takes us into a reaction. There's a wonderful phrase. It's an ancient Tibetan saying, which goes like this. When the sun is shining and my belly is full, I look like a Dharma practitioner. But when troubles arise, my faults are exposed. So it's really challenging us to work with the difficulties and bring into practice. It's very helpful in doing that to really have some clear sense in terms of the different challenges in our life, personal as well as engaging with the world, right? What is the degree of difficulty of this particular situation? I have found that very, very helpful to actually know when we look to difficult situations. And I use the 0 to 10 scale of divers, right? And say, where is this on the 0 to 10 scale? is really good to know, because if we go, you know, often we want to go right to the tens, right? And that might be hard, might be too much. One of the principles I found for all of this is we train in protected environments, like here, or maybe like your home. We develop capacities, and then we gradually bring them out to places where there are higher degrees of difficulty. But that a lot of our training is going to be maybe with the level 4, 5, or 6 training. And so it's really important to take those middle-level challenges, maybe a difficult person at work, someone who we find irritating, who, of course, naturally is objectively irritating, right? Okay. No. Once I was giving a series of talks called The Dharma of Difficult People, which with difficult people in quotation marks, and one of the first blazing insights into the obvious was what defines a difficult person is that I have difficult experiences with that person. And there, that person's just doing his or her thing, right? And of course, that's not to say that many, many people might find that person difficult. That can be true. And so we look for situations which I think are of moderate difficulty, but it really is great to know, okay, this is a really high degree of difficulty. Obviously, major conflict situations, very high degree of difficulty. We each probably have our high degree of difficulty situations. Think of those as situations that we're in training to work with. And sometimes we have a choice. Sometimes they're just there with, right, in our lives. You don't have a choice. You have to deal with it. But I think it's very helpful, particularly in terms of having some compassion for oneself, for one's limits, for, you know, giving oneself some slack to say, okay, this is a degree of difficulty 10 situation, and I'm doing my best, right? And say, oh, here's a degree of difficulty 5 situation at work. Thank you so much for being there for me with your degree of difficulty level 5. I'm so grateful. You know, you are making possible for me to practice so I can come to level 10 with my beloved family member. So very important principle. Another important principle here is that we take, in a sense, responsibility for our experience. This is huge, right? It's really another way of saying I commit to being responsive. But this really means that other people, a very key aspect of this is that other people can be triggers to my experience, but they don't cause my experience. It's a really crucial principle. And one, even our language, that our typical use of English, I don't know how it is in other languages, but I imagine it's similar. Even our ordinary use of language makes it sound like other people cause our experience. We say, you made me angry. Right? Or you did this, as if the person was causing my upset. When you look carefully at your experience, you'll see that, again, there can be trigger of one's experience, but whether I get angry when someone says something or does something is actually going to be dependent in significant part on my internal factors. And we know many situations where something made me angry 5 years ago or 10 years ago, and it doesn't make me angry now, so to speak. Or, you know, I was using the sloppy language there, sorry. But or that it doesn't lead to me being angry. You know? So that's a really key point. So this means we take radical responsibility for our experience. That is extremely challenging, right? Especially with difficult situations, difficult interactions. Can I do that? That's part of what being responsive means. So literally it means there's nothing that could happen in my experience that I don't want to take responsibility for. Again, recognizing their degrees of difficulty 0 to 10. Okay, so we move to working with thoughts and emotions. You know, in the series, the two talks I gave in I think end of January and February, we talked about using heart practices in the context of difficult experiences. Very, very valuable. I was thinking of really three main ways to work with thoughts and emotions. And I'm going to especially talk about one of them, working with mindfulness investigation, but some of the others come in, that we can first, when there, particularly when there's a challenging situation that comes up, it's very important, if we're knocked out of balance, to first be, to come back to balance. We can't actually use mindfulness or a lot of our tools if I'm caught in terms of my body, you know, getting caught physiologically in some intense reaction, being flooded, you know, with, you know, difficulty, something's just happened, and the physiology can make it very hard to do anything other than be reactive sometimes. And so a very key aspect, the first aspect I'll talk about is coming back to balance if we're out of balance. The second will be using mindfulness and wisdom to explore thoughts and emotions. And the third will be using some other skillful means with thoughts and emotions. I'll primarily, right now, talk about the first two. So coming back to balance is really, really crucial. Having a repertoire and knowing that one's out of balance. So mindfulness is going to be really crucial for letting me know I'm out of balance. And out of balance means that the reactivity is taken over, that my mind is not centered, that, as it were, the reactivity is in charge. And very crucial to know that. You know, and so, for example, at times when we know that, we may want to suspend action. Very, very crucial. You know, if we were looking at anger, for example, a very crucial way to work with anger is to know when, I think this goes for some of the other emotions as well, self-judgment and what that can bring on, depressive states and so forth, and fear and so forth. When these things have taken over and I'm reactive, I need to have a lot of ways to come back to balance. Or I need to have just one way, especially in the moment. But it's helpful to have a repertoire. You know, I can remember a time when my mind just was really thinking in crazy ways. And I remember going down all the things that usually worked. And I went down one after another, and none of them worked. But I was trying them. And eventually actually being in nature really worked. So we have, probably you could think of a number of ways that help you when you're out of balance. What would occur to you right now?
Sometimes going into the body.
Sometimes relaxing. Sometimes breathing, right? You say breathe. You could do qigong as a way to balance the body. What are some other ways to balance the body?
Yeah. Music.
Music, yeah, music might be good. Or I was thinking just something vigorous, physical exercise. Take a walk. Sometimes being in the same space, things get very tight. So change the space. Take a walk, go outside, you know. I remembered I used to be part of Sabre Graduate School, and we had monthly faculty meetings that lasted from 10 to 4. And I had a regular practice after those meetings. I would go home, and I would get home, and I would go right into about half an hour of vigorous swimming, because it really made a huge difference. It's clearing, you know. In some conditions, actually, working with the body is more skillful than working in meditation. You know, particularly when there's some way we're stuck, where the physiology has changed and so forth. So you're mentioning music, you know, something often, what?
Playing.
Yeah, playing music. Playing music oneself. Yeah, or listening. Something that could be, something active often can, like active redirecting of the energy can be very, very wonderful. Being with beauty in various ways. Being in the forest, the mountains, the ocean. Please.
For me, it's
singing.
It's a whole different level of whatever comes.
Yeah. So singing is quite beautiful. One's both intentionally going to beauty in a way, and then it also has a big impact on the body. Because in all of these emotions, the bodily part of it's really crucial. Right? And so something like singing, chanting can be wonderful. Yeah. Please. Cup of tea, drink of water, you know, there's old stories. Some of you know. I think it's a story that Thich Nhat Hanh tells, and Mara, the Buddhist personification of the devil, comes, and the Buddha says, "Oh, welcome! Won't you come in and have a cup of tea with me?" Which essentially means, "Let me be with this difficult experience, but we'll just have a cup of tea. We'll be friendly and relaxed, and so forth." So, maybe one or two others, please.
I have a couple of poems that I really kind of like to.
Yeah. So poems, some familiar text. It could be reading something, please.
Oh, I antidote whatever the negative emotional state is by going out and connecting in another way with somebody.
Yeah. So finding some ways to shift the energy, being with a friend, just talking about it sometimes, being in someone else's presence. All these things are amazing. Could be, there are others. We could read a text. I often think I've talked at times about this. I have a set of intentions, which I say typically four times a day, which takes like 2 or 3 minutes. And it's very grounding, and if I wake up in the middle of the night and something is on my mind, I will typically go right to that. And there's a way that is very soothing and grounding. And we look for things that shift the energy, actually. And we haven't mentioned even the heart practices, which are classic ways to shift the energy. Metta or loving kindness traditionally was an antidote to fear. Yeah.
Question. In this practice, I often wonder, am I not wanting to face the difficult thing?
Yeah.
Well, this event will recur forever unless you turn and face it and look at it and see its causes. So if I try and get myself to a more calm state, which sometimes I can do, but then I haven't looked at what the root cause of...
Right, so your name is?
Shaya.
Shaya?
Shaya.
Yeah, so Shaya's, am I pronouncing it right? Shaya?
Yes.
Yeah. So Shaya's question... It comes right at the exact right time. It's a segue to the next section. My talk. So thank you. We're in alignment. So it's this wonderful question about what about might I use some of the tools we've just mentioned to get away from difficult emotions or in the service of aversion? Or might I use those in a way that prevents me actually from being with, looking at, examining, getting to the roots of the challenging experiences. And so what we're looking to do is to come back to balance, because I think we can't use well the tools of mindfulness and inquiry and bringing in wisdom when we're significantly out of balance. It's probably a matter of degree. What degree of balance do I need before I can actually look at the experience? Because you're right, the deep transformation is going to occur when we look at the difficult emotions and thoughts and work with them, see into them more clearly. And the tools that we've mentioned, I think of as means to an end. And we can think of it at least two ways. One of them is that those tools that help us come back to balance prevent us from being lost or stuck in the difficult thoughts, emotions, body states, right? They help us to avoid being stuck. Being stuck, it's actually something that I've increasingly been aware of. It's really important to know the difference between mindfulness and being stuck. And it's not always easy to note. We can be sitting there vaguely aware that I am caught in reactive thoughts in relation to my partner. And I'm vaguely aware of that, and I just keep on doing it for the whole sitting, right? And I say, "Oh, how is your mindfulness?" "Okay." But we're actually more or less lost and stuck, and that's actually not helpful. We're basically training in reactivity if we're doing that. But it's a matter of degree. We want to see when is there enough balance so that I can actually explore and be mindful. And I think it's a great question to ask. Am I mindful or am I stuck? If I'm stuck, we use these tools and we come out of it. And then the second really value of these tools is that they bring us to a place where we can actually be mindful, explore, be with. And so it might be that I come back to balance. Maybe I do some physical exercise or listen to some music, and actually the negative thoughts are still there, but I'm more balanced, and then I can look at them. And so then I wanted to talk about one major practice that I imagine that Philip has used this. I haven't taught this here. And it's this wonderful practice that we call the practice of RAIN. R-A-I-N. It's an acronym. It stands for a four-part process to work with thoughts and emotions. How many of you are familiar with this? And how many not? Okay, great. So I'll hope to go over this in a way that can deepen our sense of it and invite us to practice this in the next week. The four parts are: the R stands for recognition, the A stands for acceptance or allowing, the I stands for investigation and inquiry, and the N stands for non-identification. And so I'll go through those, and we can think about how to work with those with both everyday thoughts and emotions and then difficult ones. And may our use of RAIN lead to further RAIN in the fall. Okay. So we could think of the method of using these four parts to work with the thoughts and emotions, including difficult ones, as a way to decondition reactivity. You know, the whole approach of using awareness, mindfulness, skillful means is to work to decondition our reactivity and go, as Shiloh was talking about, go to the roots of what may be causing repetitive cycles of anger, irritation, fear, judgment, whatever. That we want to go into them, have a way to work with them that actually leads us to insight. Because I think your question is really showing us that the aim of the practice is freedom and being able to be responsive. And actually, when I'm out of balance and I'm just using these tools to come back to balance, I may not be able to be very responsive to the outer situation, you know. In a way, I'm being responsive to what's going on in myself. It's like the mother, you know, who puts on her seatbelt first, or the belt in the airplane first before helping with the child. You have to take care of yourself and come back to balance. But we may not be so responsive if we're just saying, God, I'm way out of balance, let me come back to balance. So this method helps us to go into situations that help us increasingly to be responsive. So the R stands for recognize. We could also talk about it as noting or naming, really seeing what's there. It could be an answer to the question, which is really great to do, great to ask, what's happening? And just continually asking, what's happening right now? Especially if we feel a little bit confused. If we're not sure what's happening, or we feel a little bit lost, to ask the question, what's happening? And sometimes we can name it. And we just start wherever we are. Part of the practice of using RAIN has a depth dimension. We start where it's accessible. I mean, I might start and just say, I'm really anxious. You know, I may not know what's at the bottom of it, but that's what's most accessible. And so I name it. And the naming of it can set the rest of the RAIN process in motion. And so I can really begin to work as skillfully as possible with what's come up. So when I notice reactivity or confusion, I say, what's happening? And I try to sense. Maybe all I can do is know I'm confused, right? And I don't know the emotions, and I don't know what's happening in the body, but I know there's confusion, and that's a starting point. The A stands for accepting or allowing. This is really seeing where there's resistance to what's happening. And as much as possible, letting go of the resistance. Sometimes we may say to ourselves, yes, this is really here, and see if we can just, in a sense, let be. We may have had a wonderful day, might have received a difficult email or a difficult phone call, and all of a sudden I'm reactive. I'm sitting out here in San Rafael, looking at the beautiful nature, and I just feel very reactive. I'm angry and irritated. And I say, I shouldn't be angry and irritated. It's so beautiful here. And just to say, okay, relax, Donald. When I first came out to California, I remember I was staying in Berkeley for a summer as part of a program, and I would come over the Richmond-San Rafael Bridge. This was like 25 years ago, and I would say, how can anyone be in a bad mood in the Bay Area? It is so beautiful here. You know, I was coming from living in Kentucky, where I had been for a while, and it didn't take that long to realize how there could be a coexistence of beauty and irritation. But we would, you know, we might have that sense of, this shouldn't be here. This is my day off. I shouldn't get nasty emails on my day off. How dare they? Back into reactivity. And so we allow it. We say, okay, this is here. Let me be with it. Let me just be present to it. We want to be careful, and this is, again, related to your question. With all of this, there can be a tendency to use meditation, either subtly or not so subtly, to try to make things go away. Do you know that one? This is like the occupational hazard number one or three, or it's up there. With our practice, that we might think, yes, I'm really open to difficult experiences, but by my skillful meditation, they will all go away. Right? So we want to watch for that, because that's, you know, we really actually have to be willing just to be with the hard stuff. And there's part of us who thinks that if I meditate enough, there won't be any more hard stuff. I thought that. No one, they don't say that in the advertisements, do they? No. But isn't that sort of subtle? How many people thought if you meditated enough, you'd never have difficult experiences enough? I guess it depends on what age you start meditation. I mean, start meditation old enough. That's no one. You're not going to believe that. But I started it pretty young and naive. So anyway, yeah. And, you know, once we have to look at that resistance, look at that subtle motivation to make things go away. Look at, is what's happening clashing with my self-image? You know? You know, I'm a meditator. I don't get irritated and angry so much. You know, and so essentially we want to see those things and let go into the experience. So the eye of rain is investigation and inquiry. And this is where we are just with the experience, and especially challenging with difficult experiences. Can I just be with the difficult physical experiences or the difficult emotions? When we're with challenging states, we can go back and forth between what's there on the emotional level, what's happening in my body, what's the thought pattern. With difficult experiences, a key thing to identify is there a repetitive negative narrative occurring, a negative storyline? There almost always is with a lot of very persistent repetitive thoughts. It could be, this shouldn't be happening to me, or it could be, that person is at fault, or, you know, I've done it again. It could be connected with self-judgment. We really want to track for those and really notice them. It's one of the fruits of our practice. As I said, when we investigate and inquire, there's a depth dimension which starts occurring, where we start actually seeing more deeply. That's why we start with mindfulness wherever we find something happening. But as we stay with it, we can actually go sometimes to what's beneath the surface. When we stay with something, sometimes, you know, what I've found practicing with anger, for example, a lot of psychologists say that anger is a cover emotion. Maybe you've heard that. There's often hurt or pain or something else beneath the anger. And so I have found that when I stay with anger, it's actually very crucial just to stay with it, track it, what's it like in the body, what's going on, And then when it shifts, what else is there? And sometimes I've found I stay with anger, and after a while I notice sadness. Sadness can appear. Oh, and I stay with sadness, and sometimes something else appears. Sometimes even beneath the sadness can be love. And that we actually, if we stay with difficult emotions sometimes, we can actually have incredible information come our way. Oh, I'm really angry at this person. Sometimes it's clear. I'm angry at my child who went out to the street, and there's love beneath it. I can feel that sometimes when I settle down from the anger. But sometimes I might find things that are I didn't know at first. We want to investigate. We can start seeing patterns. When we are really looking into experiences, we can start to see what was the stimulus that led to this reaction. Some of this can be reflective, to really notice stimulus. Where does it, then where do I typically go? What was the pattern? Sometimes it's reflective. Sometimes we can notice that in the process of staying with the experiences. As we stay with the thoughts and emotions, we can move more into non-identification. Could be some people have called it not taking it personally, where we start seeing this more as a process that's going on, and I'm like a scientist, and I'm studying a natural process, like the American monk in the Thai forest tradition, Achan Sumedho, says, look at that. Look at despair. It's like this. And he holds his hand up. We want to study it. It's like this. What is it like? Oh, look at that. Look at my irritation. Oh, look at that. Look, here's what it feels like in the body. And we really start to have a sense of awareness of the process without so much being attached. I want this. I don't want this. This is a fruit of our practice. You know, in the Thai forest tradition, a fundamental distinction is made between the awareness, which can track what's going on, and the actual contents of experience. There's a beautiful passage. Maybe I'll finish with this and one other comment, that we can actually be with the experience with the spirit of non-identification. This is from Achan Cha, the teacher of Jack Kornfield, and maybe some other people you know. Just go into the room and put a chair in the center. It's the chair of awareness. Take the seat in the center of the room, open the doors and windows, and see who comes to visit. You will witness all kinds of scenes and actors, all kinds of temptations and stories imaginable. Your only job is to stay in the seat. You get that sense of staying with awareness. You will see it all arise and pass, and out of this wisdom and understanding will come. As I see it, the mind is like a single point, the center of the universe. And mental states are like visitors who come to stay at this point for short or long periods of time. Get to know these visitors well. Become familiar with the vivid pictures they paint, the alluring stories they tell to entice you to follow them. But do not give up your seat. It is the only chair around. If you continue to occupy it unceasingly, greeting each guest as it comes, firmly establishing yourself in awareness, transforming your mind into the one who knows, the one who is awake, the visitors will eventually stop coming back. If you give them real attention, how many times can these visitors return? Speak with them here and you'll know every one of them well. Then your mind will at last be at peace. This quality of this deep awareness that can just allow the process to occur. So maybe to end with, let me see if I can remember this. It's from the poet William Butler Yeats. He said, to look at oneself unflinchingly takes more courage than a soldier on a battlefield. To look at oneself unflinchingly takes more courage than a soldier on a battlefield. That's our practice. To look at oneself and move towards that responsiveness. That's our practice. And we do it ourselves, and then we bring it out into the world, which deeply needs these capacities, as we can see. Thank you. We have a little bit of time for questions, discussions? Do we, what, Diane, do we go what, till what time?
Until 8 o'clock.
But for the, we shift to the meta cards at
right,
what time?
It's usually the last 5 or 7 minutes or something.
Okay, so we have a little less than 10 minutes. Okay, please.
I love the way you frame taking responsibility for your own experience.
Yeah.
I've been working with that for years since therapy, where I'm going to say, this is what I'm feeling, this is.
Yeah.
You're with somebody else who takes that as an accusation. When you start with, I'm feeling frustration, or I'm feeling anger, or I'm feeling fear here, if somebody else comes back with, well, I didn't intend to do that, and you're blaming me, and I say, I'm not blaming you, I'm just telling you what I'm feeling. No, I feel, and that person says, you're blaming me. And a cycle goes on, because not everybody we interact with has the same teachings we do.
That is true.
So I find myself in negative spirals sometimes.
Okay.
I'm trying to take responsibility for my own emotions, but I'm up against somebody saying that I'm blaming that person for that emotion, when in fact I'm only claiming it for myself.
Right. Okay, so great question about how to respond when I take responsibility for my own emotions, and I, in this case, I speak them, say what they are, identify them verbally, and another person interprets what you're saying in this case as implying that this person caused your negative experiences, right?
Right.
Right. So, first of all, we could frame this as a fairly high degree of difficulty situation. That's helpful, just to know that that's the case. And then I think it's really the fact that I take responsibility for my own emotions doesn't dictate what I say to the other person. In other words, with some people, that might not be skillful. If I know that there's a tendency for that person to interpret it, you know, as blaming, then you know, it may be very helpful for me to do my own inner work more silently. And again, of course, try to be empathic towards that person. But whether or not one verbalizes, this is the emotion I'm feeling, is going to depend on what's skillful in the situation. In some situations, it won't be skillful. Yeah, and that, I think, probably with that person. And yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, we have to, it's a lot of subtleties, right? Yeah, thank you. Please. Why don't we say your names also?
Oh, it's Isabel.
Yeah.
So I get sometimes intimidated by the men that I work with. The men that I work with.
Yeah.
I work with all guys because I work with developers. And
yeah.
I'm trying to apply what you're saying so that I can be more more effective at work.
Yeah.
But I don't know how to frame it the way you do. I mean,
yeah, and would you mind saying, one or two typical challenges that come up in that context?
I can be assertive around some people.
Yeah.
A lot of people, actually.
Yeah.
But some people I've been more intimidated by
than
others.
Yeah. So your sense of intimidation in some situations, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, useful to give it some place on the degree of difficulty scale, you know. And if there, it sounds like there may be gender issues,
mm-hmm.
right? And to know that there are those gender issues, and if you identify these as high on the scale of difficulty, then you might look for ways to work with similar situations at lower degrees of difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So maybe there's some way. You know, there's some typical patterns maybe of tendencies to be dominating.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say that might happen. Are there places, are there places that you can try to work with that where it's more manageable,
mm-hmm.
and you can train there? And then you can, it's helpful to know what's going on internally.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, generally, I think in these interpersonal situations, a full response would be doing both inner work and outer response. You know, so there's a place for both of them. And sometimes the inner response can be quite helpful without even being concerned about how you're going to interact. Just as a part of the process is to see what's going on with me. You know, what am I feeling? Does this trigger old memories? You know, and so forth, and to really know that. And and then, you know, there are a lot of other possibilities. In an interpersonal situation, there are many possibilities. I mean, if you can find allies, maybe it's something about the work culture, you know, that you can bring up. Maybe it's too hard to bring up. Maybe you could bring it up. You know, if there's some patterns, finding allies is really crucial. And some of this is long-term. But we could probably identify 5 or 10 different ways to respond. Connected with our practice, we'd want to look at what's going on internally as part of that. You know, so there's a few, we could probably take that and go on for 40 minutes on that. Please, in the back, yeah.
Someone recently had a book called Getting Real.
Yeah.
And I thought there's trouble here because it wasn't, this is the truth of my own heart, which is what I would have named the book. Anyway, so they said one of the rules was kindness.
Sorry, I'm not hearing so well.
One of the rules was kindness.
For kindness, yeah.
Yeah. So I pointed out that Donald Rothberg has talked about right speech, right? And my timing.
Yeah.
And that you can have three.
Oh, that's
four,
right.
But you need 4 out of 4.
Yeah.
So.
These are the guidelines for skillful speech.
Right. Yeah. So I thought.
Yeah.
This person who was talking about this might connect the two.
Yeah.
But instead, I got a very unskillful, let's say, phone call, lashing out. Well, it felt very hurtful.
Yeah.
You know, and in that situation. You know, I don't say how unskillful of you, but I do feel hurt, and I want the person to know that it could have been handled a different way or something.
Yeah.
So where is there like a little world of feedback? It wouldn't be I'm
okay.
feeling angry, because that's always a problem.
Okay, we are bringing out higher degree of difficulty situations. And this will be my last response here. So it is good to know it's quite difficult and a difficult situation. And how I actually respond is really going to be context dependent. You know, I can't really generalize. It's going to be totally based on what is the receptivity of the person. With some people, it would be skillful to say nothing. With some people, it would be skillful to be quite explicit if there was someone who had the capability to hear you empathically. Then they could be very skillful, you know, if you use your best skillful language, nonviolent communication style maybe, and you take, you know, you speak in a way which is very related to your own experience, being very careful not to make interpretations of the other or say things which will tend to put the other person on defensive, but have like a Martin Buber style I thou connection. That might be possible. And then you might say that was very difficult and frustrating for me. And I think, again, I would frame it, what I found, you know, from my own teaching, my own practice, and from studying different speech systems, is that your initial stance is really to really be careful about saying anything that would put the other person on the defensive.
What? What I've learned in my next few years of life is that when someone is really defensive, I tend to think that pointing something out gently or something, that you're going to get by the defense. But what I have found with some people is that no way, by definition. You know.
Yeah, generally, nothing gets by the defense,
right.
Usually. So you'd have to, if the person's totally defensive, you have to think of this as advanced practice, high degree of difficulty. This is where it's really crucial to practice with similar situations that are lower degrees of difficulty, maybe where the person is not defensive. and really think of these as a little more extreme situations, and the bulk of our practice is going to be elsewhere.
Yes, sir.
Is elsewhere. We build the capacities not with these more extreme situations, but with easier situations. And that, you know, and so, you know, sometimes empathy is a wonderful move, you know, to really make an empathic stance. Oh, you, I sense you're really frustrated now, or this is really difficult for you. You know, so there's a lot, there's beautiful work, and you know, again, there are a number of books. And let me, because of time, I think we want to have adequate time for the metta cards.
Okay, I'll read you.
And but just thank you for your questions, and that last one could also use a 40-minute addendum. Just want to acknowledge that it just began. Thank you.
For Heidi Jane, suffering with loss and self-doubt. For Gloria, who has just been diagnosed with advanced lung cancer, and her family who is caring for her. For Rose, who just had back surgery. Metta for Elizabeth and her family and friends as she is dying from brain cancer. For Lorene and her new kidney.
Thank you. So many situations where if we know ones like that, we can be responsive. You know, again, it's about working with our own minds, but it's also about bringing out, like we looked at in January and February, those qualities of the heart. And, you know, this is why I'm glad that we have two sessions. There were hands up that I couldn't get to. There were great questions that I could give, hopefully adequate, but just beginning responses to. And so we have another time next week. My invitation would be to focus on practicing with thoughts and emotions, using, if you wish, that RAIN method: recognition, allowing or accepting, investigation, non-identification. Work with that method. Use the ways of coming back to balance that we talked about. But I think the key is a starting point, really maybe having the intention once or twice or three times during the day when, or in the meditation, when challenging thoughts and emotions come up, I'm going to work with them. I'm going to really look out for them, know they're happening. Sometimes I'll do that which helps me come back to balance. Sometimes I'll investigate. I'll work with them on the spot. Yeah. Something else which we can do, also, we didn't do it this time, is you can actually sometimes call forth an experience you've had earlier in the day, like a difficult emotion, and just kind of bring it to life by remembering it, and then work with RAIN right there. I didn't go into that so much, but you can actually say, okay, let me, that difficult interaction, let me remember that. Okay, let me feel that in my body. Oh, there's anger. Oh, let me use, okay, I feel that right now, I'm reliving it some. Let me, now that it's here, let me work with the RAIN method. It's a possible technique to use. So my invitation is to work with this in the next week. Take notes. Bring back stories. Bring back insights and questions. How many would like to do this in the next week? Raise your hand. Okay. Great. So that'll be our focus again. I think I'll bring in more detailed looking at some of the particular challenging emotions. I'm hearing a lot of interest in how do I communicate, right? How do I speak? You know, which I think maybe last year, I think I gave some talks on skillful speech, and you know, it's an interest of mine, as many of you know, and teach on it quite a bit. So I'll see if I can bring some of that in. It's a lot just to start bringing in speech. It's a major variable. Yeah, but I hear that as an interest. Great. So let's sit to finish. Do two things. First, to invite to be present whatever may have been helpful from the evening, may have been something related to the talk, the discussion, or maybe something else came up in your sitting or totally independent of the theme that was important for you. just let be present, whatever was important to you from the evening. And then invite your intention for the next week. And then closing with the energy of loving kindness. Feel in your heart maybe a sense of goodwill or kindness or wishing well for yourself, for others, wherever it's easiest to access. Could be for someone in your life. Could be a child, a pet. Now, however you best access that sense of kindness, let that be there in your heart and come out from the heart in front of you, behind you, to left and right, above and below, filling up this room. Wishing well for all of us here. All of us human beings with the glories and the challenges of being a human being. Filling up the space of the room, radiating out from your heart in all directions. And then moving beyond this building out into the world. In all directions, left and right, above and below, in front and behind. Going out throughout our world. And going in all directions without limit. With the energy of kindness, of goodwill, of wishing well. Finally coming back just to feeling one's own heart sitting here in this room. Ready to begin a week with our best kindness, compassion, and wisdom. May they guide us.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Thank you, and to be continued.